Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
In the city.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. France raised a red flag on Washington's war plans yesterday, hinting that it might veto any Security Council resolution authorizing war in Iraq if the UN weapons inspectors aren't given more time. President Bush thundered back at the Gallic broadside, responding today that Iraq will be disarmed by a coalition of the willing. Critics accuse the Bush administration of impatience, but President Bush's diplomatic strong-arming has revitalized the Security Council. Inspectors are in Iraq. Baghdad has agreed to let Iraqi scientists talk. Bush-brand coercive diplomacy is working, even as Bush says it's not. Is the U.S. safer today with inspectors in Iraq? Would an attack on Iraq make us less safe? Is the threat of war more effective than war itself? And should Washington keep the tough talk coming, only hold the war? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is James Bone, UN correspondent for The Times of London. James Bone, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Set us up, set our conversation up, James. We want to move you from New York to Baghdad and back to New York. What happened yesterday in the Security Council, and what is its significance?
Well, the first thing to remember is that next Monday there's the 60-day report by the chief weapons inspectors on the level of Baghdad's cooperation. And then the second thing to remember is that there's been a test laid down by the Security Council when it passed a resolution in November on what Iraq must do in order to comply. And the test has two parts. The first part is that there should be no false statements or omissions in its declaration of its weapons programs. And the second part is that it shouldn't fail to provide full cooperation. That is the legal test. That's what everybody agreed to in the Security Council in a 15-0 vote at the beginning of November. Now, the question looming for next Monday is, has Iraq met that test? And the answer is, obviously, in both respects, it hasn't met that test. But the problem is that many countries don't want to accept that Iraq has not met that test and are willing to go along with less complete Iraqi cooperation and a declaration riddled with omissions, because they think that's a better alternative, a containment alternative, than having an outright war.
Mm. Now, the French, there was some talk about even a veto of a war resolution, should it come to that, before the Security Council. Has an ally ever vetoed another ally's position in the Security Council?
Yes, it occasionally happens. I mean, it quite often happens that the Americans veto things on Israel when the Europeans vote for them, so that's not unheard of. The last time the French actually exercised a veto against the United States was during the Suez Crisis in 1956, so that would be rare. It is rare for people to veto things the United States wants to do, although Russia occasionally does it and China occasionally does it.
Of course, this has political ramifications here, too. We see a Newsweek poll that says while 6 in 10 Americans support a UN-sanctioned attack on Iraq, only 3 in 10 support a war without the imprimatur of the UN. Is that part of the background conversation there? That are the U.S. diplomats beginning to sense that they're also dealing with American politics there?
Well, I mean, the whole reason the Americans came to the UN in the first place was because Colin Powell put the argument that the Americans shouldn't do this alone, needed allies, and the UN was where you found allies. And that obviously has a large impact on public opinion in America. Americans would feel a lot happier, as would, you know, British people, if any military action were taken within the context of UN authority. But you have to remember there has been military action taken by the Americans outside the framework of UN action. For instance, the 1998 bombing of, mm-hmm. of Iraq when Iraq forced out the weapons inspectors, and also the intervention in Kosovo. That also wasn't specifically sanctioned by the Security Council.
Mm-hmm. Now, the French were saying that they want things to run at least another 2 months. What did the UN diplomat or the U.S. diplomats say about that? And how does that French timetable sort of jibe with General Sumner in Iraq?
Well, the French seem to be saying, let us get through the fighting season and then we'll have less to worry about. So they're basically, rather than saying an outright no to the Americans, saying, well, let's talk about it in 2 months' time. Mm-hmm. There is another date in the inspection schedule at the end of March when there will be another big report. So they're looking towards that date to try and play the game long. And the Americans have been trying to bring forward the various dates in the inspection schedule to keep a tempo up. And it's quite likely there will be, after this January 27th meeting on Monday, it's quite likely there will be an agreement on a mid-February report before the next scheduled report on March 1st, and then the following one after that will be the end of March.
So you think the UN, the US, will wait for that second report?
I think that at the moment it looks as though mid-February is emerging as the crucial date at mm-hmm. the UN. I mean, obviously, Bush can make a case in the State of the Union address. The Security Council is then coming back next Wednesday mm-hmm. for consultations. Blair is then going to see Bush on Friday. So, I mean, there's a kind of increased tempo of decision-making.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that they might still, at least from the British point of view, is quite likely to seek a clinching report by the inspectors in mid-February. Also, I think that one thing that is not properly understood by the public is that the inspections, although they've been going on since November 27th in Iraq, have only really become serious since the first few days of January, which isn't very long ago, mm-hmm. With proper intelligence sharing. Until then, the inspectors were simply going to sites that Iraq had put on a list,
mm-hmm.
and Iraq knew those sites would be inspected, and presumably anything they didn't want to be discovered, they would have moved from those sites. What happened since the beginning of this month is the inspectors have gone to some other places. For instance, they went to the home of a scientist or two scientists,
mm-hmm.
and they found 3,000 pages of documents unexplained about a laser isotope separation uranium enrichment program.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is very suggestive evidence. We don't fully know the details of that yet. The inspectors haven't reported on it. But, it seems that the inspectors, even in the first few days of proper intelligence sharing and proper aggressive inspections, have begun to make discoveries. And I think the British and Americans anticipate further discoveries over the next week, maybe not by next Monday, but maybe by mid-February, they're confident. There are another lot of inspectors being trained up in Vienna now.
Mm-hmm.
Be going in, and they may include some more aggressive characters, and they may expect those people to make some real discoveries in Iraq. Iraq has a lot of stuff. I mean, people have to realize there's a great amount of kit mm-hmm. in Iraq, a lot of weapons of mass destruction
mm-hmm.
That have been somehow lost and unaccounted for, that Iraq has admitted making and not properly explained what's happened to them. And so when the inspectors find, as they did the other day, a dozen artillery rocket warheads, 122-millimeter artillery rocket warheads that are modified to carry chemical weapons, they shouldn't really be surprised, because Iraq has admitted having mm-hmm. 80,000 or something of these things. So mm-hmm. if you find 12, you shouldn't be particularly surprised. They're not meant to have any left anymore, but they had such enormous numbers of these things, it's not surprising you should be able to find some of them.
Mm. Joining us now on the line is Lawrence Korb. He's the former Assistant Secretary of Defense during the Reagan administration. Currently, he's the Director of National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Lawrence Korb, thank you so much for joining us.
Nice to be with you.
Lawrence Korb, a few months ago on our show, in fact, I think just after President Bush's UN speech, you said, just having the inspectors there is going to slow down their development of weapons of mass destruction. Just having them there, quite apart from anything they find, is a good thing. The French foreign minister said the same thing the other day. And today we had, and yesterday the Iraqis agreed to 9-10 various demands on the part of the inspectors to make these inspections more meaningful. Question to you. Is U.S. coercive diplomacy working here?
Well, there's no doubt about the fact that Bush, by getting the United Nations to pass a tough resolution by moving military forces into the area, has basically, made it clear to Saddam that if he resists openly, there will be war, and they'll have support of the international community. So, yeah, I mean, Bush, in a certain sense, is in a no-lose position now, depending on how he plays it, because if he goes along with the French demand and lets the inspections go on, even without war, he can say, well, that my build-up and, you know, my threats is what mm-hmm. worked, and look mm-hmm. what he's turning over. Look how cooperative he's been. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if, in fact, it appears that he is not cooperating, that the inspectors find real serious material breaches, that he's ready to go to war.
And he can say, yes, but at some point they're going to have to make the turn from disparaging what's being found and disparaging the cooperation that to saying, well, there is progress being made, and saying the glass is half full.
That's right. Now, where he loses, in my view, is if he goes by himself without any support, even if the Prime Minister Blair says, well, let's wait another month or something. He says, no, we're going to go now. Then I think he does lose even in the United States. So I think if, as was discussed earlier, if you wait at least until the end of February, it doesn't look like you're rushing into anything.
Mm-hmm. And having troops stationed there, that isn't something that's, in other words, they don't have to be used for war. They're doing a job just by being there, right?
Well, that's true. They would be doing a certain amount of training anyway. Your problem is you can't leave all of them there, say, over the summer, if you're going to wait till, as I think was just pointed out, I think quite appropriately, the so-called fighting season ends. So I think you have to be careful with that, and you've got other things. You know, you've called up reservists. How long do you keep them on active duty? We've invoked the stop-loss provision for the Marines, which, you know, means people can't get out of the service. So those are some things you're going to have to think about if you don't go to war this spring, and you do wait till the fall.
Is there a minimum amount of troops, do you think, that would have the coercive impact without these negative effects?
Well, I think about 150,000, certainly. When you go beyond that, then you get into what we used to call it the building, working in the building, is kind of a use it or lose it, because you can't leave all of those troops there on this high level of readiness mm-hmm. for long. And at that number, it's pretty hard to rotate them. With 150,000, you can start rotating them back and forth, but you get into what you kind of call a tipping point when you get over 200,000.
Mm-hmm. James Bone, but back to you. Are people at the UN saying, wait a minute, even if we're finding things, that's an example that, yes, they're hiding things, but also that the inspections are working, whereas the U.S. looks at the same things and says, nope, they're hiding things. If they're hiding this, they're hiding more. Is that an ambiguity
Well, there's a catch-22, isn't there? I mean, if they don't find anything, then people say there's nothing there to find. And if they do find something, people say, well, this just shows that the inspections work. Mm-hmm. So I don't think, I mean, that's definitely the French line. And there's a debate going on, basically. There's quite a large constituency at the UN of which the French are part, and I would say Hans Blix is increasingly outspoken a part of it, which is that containment, even if there's less than full cooperation by the Iraqis, is preferable to war. And that argument was articulated by the French Foreign Minister Dominique de Villepin yesterday, and when he said, you know, Iraq's weapons programs are frozen at the moment by the presence of inspectors. And it's being articulated for about the last week by Hans Blix, the chief inspector, who's begun to say, well, you know, we have 300 men and we cost $80 million dollars a year paid out of Iraq's oil proceeds, and war would take 250,000 men and cost $100 billion, so which is better? So, you know, you can see the shape of the argument, where there is a containment argument playing against the more absolutist argument, which is that, you know, we've got to solve this problem, you know, given that Saddam hasn't had a conversion on the road to Damascus, so to speak, and isn't rendering up all his hidden weapons, you know, we've just got to take him out and put in a regime that will give them up.
James Bone, thank you very much for joining us. James Bone is the UN correspondent for the London Times. We're going to be coming right back. We're talking about, well, whether the glass in Iraq is half full, whether our coercive diplomacy is working, whether war is unnecessary because that diplomacy is working. Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
From Boston.
I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the half-full glass of coercive diplomacy. France announced yesterday that it wants to give UN weapons inspectors more time. Here's how President Bush responded earlier today.
This is not about inspectors. This is about a disarmed Iraq. He has weapons of mass destruction, the world's deadliest weapons, which pose a direct threat to the United States, our citizens, and our friends and allies. He has been told to disarm for 11 long years. He's not disarming. This business about, you know, more time. You know, how much time do we need to see clearly that he's not disarming? As I said, this looks like a rerun of a bad movie, and I'm not interested in watching it.
President Bush speaking at the White House earlier today. We're talking about whether our sending of troops is accomplishing what we say we want, which is to disarm Iraq. Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Lawrence Korb, the former Assistant Secretary of Defense during the Reagan administration. Currently, he's the Director of National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And now we're joined by Morton Halperin from Washington. He's the former Director of Policy and Planning at the State Department during the Clinton administration, and he is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Morton Halperin, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
Well, good to have you here. We were struck by your article a couple of months ago in the American Prospect saying that a regime of what you call containment plus is the way to deal with Iraq. And as things are sort of unfolding with our forces going there, with the inspectors digging in, it looks like something like containment plus is happening now.
Well, it's not. I don't think so. First of all, it's still likely, I think, more likely than not, that we will go to war. So that's not containment plus. We've got too many troops there to keep it up at this level. And second, we're not doing the other half of what I suggested, which is really where Secretary Powell started, namely to try to tighten the embargo so that Saddam Hussein does not get access to money from illegal oil sales, from other black market transactions, which he might be able to use to buy things to advance his weapons programs. That is a hell of a lot cheaper than going to war and could be effective if we were prepared to put pressure on the Syrians and on the Turks to do that as opposed to trying to get people to agree to support a war.
I'm shocked that we haven't done that.
Well, we haven't done that because the administration came in and started moving in that direction. Secretary Powell went to the UN and got the embargo altered so that it, on the one hand, facilitated the Iraqis buying things that were not related to weapons, and on the other hand, laid the groundwork for tightening the embargo. But then the people in the administration who were really interested in regime change, they've learned to stop saying it, but it's really what they're interested in, took over, persuaded the president that he should support their policy, and we dropped the efforts to improve and tighten the embargo and to tighten the containment policy. And we're now trying to prove that that can work in Iraq, where it can work, and ignoring the crisis in Korea, where it cannot work.
Where containment cannot work?
the kind of containment that's built on military force cannot. I think we can negotiate mm-hmm. with the Koreans mm-hmm. to get them to end their weapons of mass destruction program. Mm-hmm. I don't think we can do that with the Iraqis.
Mm-hmm. So there's been a sort of shift from the Powell approach, which was to use this diplomacy to contain Iraq, to a more military, strictly military option.
Right, which is designed really to change the regime.
Not to just to
disarm.
The
lawyers have told them that it's bad language to use, and so if you go back, you can see they're talking about regime change, and suddenly they
yeah.
stop, and they start talking about disarmament, but they're really not interested in disarmament. They're interested in regime change.
Larry Korb, are you as clear on that as Morton Halperin? I mean, I've been reading for years we've been reading about the Bush administration just hasn't been able to make up its mind between Powell and Rumsfeld. What's your read?
Well, that's right. I mean, you see it most graphically in Korea, but you also, you know, see it in what's going on in Iraq. We know now from Bob Woodward's book, we got minutes of National Security Council meetings, that people wanted to have a regime change even before September 11th. They took advantage of the mood created by September 11th to try and get opinion in this country, even, and they were never able to make a connection between September 11th and Saddam Hussein. And so that's true. And one of these days, the president's going to have to come down on one side or the other. Normally, what would happen is the president would do what he did in his economic arena, probably force one of them out. The most likely candidate, given where the president's coming from, would be Powell, but he can't. I mean, Colin Powell is an icon, and in fact, the American people probably voted for Bush did so because they thought that Powell would be part of his foreign policy team.
Mm. So to remove Powell on the analogy with the economic team is just not possible.
It isn't. And what's happening is you really see it with Korea. We're sending very, very conflicting signals to the world and at home. And a great power has to be very careful about the signals it sends. If you listen to the clip that you played from President Bush today, I could easily say, well, gee, that applies to North Korea. Weapons of mass destruction, we're not going to tolerate it. But yet, in fact, he seems to be willing to do that.
Mm. Ward Halperin, how is the scissors of these two crises working now, affecting one another?
Well, I think that, and from my point of view, the main crisis here is in Korea. And the administration, because it is determined to go to war in Iraq, keeps saying not to worry, not to worry, not to worry. And the danger is that once the North Koreans start producing more plutonium, it's going to be very hard to put that back in the cage. And you're going to have a fundamental change in the security situation in Northeast Asia, leading, I think, to the South Koreans then looking to get nuclear weapons, and then the Japanese looking to get nuclear weapons. And the only way to stop that is to negotiate with the North Koreans. But the administration is afraid that it will somehow distract attention from Iraq, and it's also ideologically opposed to negotiations. And so it's trying to pretend that this isn't serious, when in fact what the president told us was we were not going to stand by and let countries that might proliferate weapons of mass destruction get those weapons. Well, the North Koreans are much more likely to proliferate nuclear weapons than the Iraqis, and the North Koreans are capable of producing many nuclear weapons in the next few months. The Iraqis are not capable, by anyone's account, of producing nuclear weapons for 4 or 5 years, and most people think a lot longer than that. So if you take what the president said in his statements about preemption and about not allowing rogue states or evil states, as he chooses to call them, to get nuclear weapons, we're focusing on the wrong problem.
Hmm. We're talking tonight about Iraq and about asking the question whether our diplomacy is working, even if the president seems to think it's not. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Benjamin is calling from Boston. Hello.
Yeah, thank you very much. The comment I would like to make is to remind people that the present situation we find ourselves right now is not exactly what the president initially wanted to do. He came in saying he wants a regime change. It was the pressure put on by his Powell and the rest of the world that made him to change his policy from regime change to now trying something different, working with the UN. So I really don't give him credit for arriving at the particular point which we are right now, because I think the most important thing that we should have done initially is to work with the UN and try to contain this guy, which is what they're doing now. And I would like to say that no matter whatever we do, as long as Saddam Hussein remains there, you can never guarantee the fact that you've totally eliminated all the weapons he has, because there's no way you're ever going to find out. So it's like a fruitless exercise.
Yeah. Larry Korb, no way of being absolutely sure here. That's certain.
Well, that's true. But the president can't have it both ways. He can't go to the U.N., and say it's your problem and then not abide by the United Nations. And that's kind of the fix he's got himself in. I mean, it's pretty clear that it was Prime Minister Blair and Powell that convinced him to go to the UN. But I don't think he ever thought that it would, A, that Saddam would be as cooperative as he is, or it would take this long to find something. And I think that's the kind of the conundrum he's got himself in now. And that's why you see this frustration coming out, that the clip you played and some of the other things we've seen over the past couple of weeks.
And I can imagine Dick Cheney was saying just this in August. Mr. President, if we go to the UN, they're going to hold us up right through next spring.
Yeah, I have no doubt about it. In fact, Cheney gave a speech and saying inspections were useless.
Mm. Benjamin is down. Thank you. Gail is calling from Roxbury, Massachusetts. Hello and welcome.
Hi, thank you. I feel pretty much the same way the last guy felt, and I just think that Bush is just giving lip service to diplomacy or anything like it, and he just wants to get into Iraq, and I don't know why. Probably revenge, who knows? And also, when you talk about regime change, and then you have to look at North Korea, and they are more dangerous, and no, we're not doing anything about them, because they... I mean, the message that he's actually sending the world is you better get yourself some nuclear arms, because otherwise we're going to attack you.
Now, that's an interesting point. How about that, Mort Halperin?
What's deterring us from attacking North Korea is not nuclear weapons. Despite Powell trying to suggest they already have to, so this is no big deal, we don't really believe they have to. We believe they may have enough plutonium to manufacture two nuclear weapons, but the intelligence community does not believe they've actually manufactured the weapons or have any capability of delivering nuclear weapons. What deters us from attacking North Korea is their conventional military capability, and to some extent some chemical weapons capability, which is on the border between North and South Korea. That border is very close to Seoul, the capital of South Korea. And so if there was a war with North Korea, they could inflict enormous casualties on South Korean civilians, on the South Korean military, and on the U.S. military, and could deliver some weapons to Japan as well if they chose to do so. We would defeat them in a war and defeat them relatively quickly, but the damage would be enormous.
Catastrophic.
That conventional threat that deters us. We have actually done the embargo against Iraq has actually worked best in the conventional field, which is what gives us so much confidence that we can win a conventional war quickly. So we're not deterred by nuclear threats. We're deterred here by conventional weapons.
But Gail's point is a good one, isn't it? I mean, if Secretary Powell is saying, oh, they already have a weapon, isn't he giving credence to that idea that all you need to do to deter the United States
right.
is get
he
a
is
nuclear
doing,
weapon?
He is doing that. And the reason I think the administration is doing it is that they're trying to argue that what the North Koreans are about to do, which is to start producing large amounts of plutonium and presumably then to try to make them into nuclear weapons, is not a crossing a threshold because they already have two nuclear weapons, and therefore what's the big deal they have two or 12? I don't believe they have two. Certainly that is not what the intelligence community believes. And there is an enormous difference between maybe enough for two and then starting to produce 12 or more a year, which they can do if they resume operations of their reactor.
Larry Korb, is that your reading of it, too?
Yeah, that's true. And the other thing the administration is trying to do is sort of turn this argument on its head and say, see, that's why we have to go after Saddam now, because if he gets nuclear weapons, we can't.
Yes.
Can't go against North Korea.
Right. So then that by conceding or saying that North Korea has the nuclear weapons, they're making an argument for Iraq.
That's right.
Yeah. Thank you, Gail. Preston is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hello.
Hello. Actually, this follows pretty good in the same vein. One of the problems I've had with the administration's whole argument about Iraq already has weapons of mass destruction, we must take them out, we must attack. We used to play a game called Risk.
Mm-hmm.
And so one time, just for fun, we changed it into Nuclear Risk.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing you learned in Nuclear Risk is you never mass troops at the border of somebody who might have a nuke card. And yet, exactly what we're doing in Iraq is massing our troops at the border, at the same time saying they have these horrible weapons of mass destruction, they could wipe us out at any moment. Isn't that rather contradictory?
Hmm. What do you say about that, Mort Halperin?
I'm not sure I understand. What's the contradiction?
No, if indeed the administration believes
That Iraq has nuclear weapons
and have these horrible weapons of mass destruction, would you put all your troops right in harm's way so they could be wiped out in a single stroke?
It doesn't believe that. And it doesn't believe they're going to use weapons of mass destruction. I mean, the Iraqis may have some chemical weapons. They may have some limited kinds of biological weapons. They do not have a nuclear weapon. They do not have the capacity to attack large concentrations of troops. And nobody really believes that they do.
Are you at all frightened, though, of the scenario that if they conclude that war is inevitable, they could pull some sort of preemptive strike
I mean, I think that what I said, some months ago before the Foreign Relations Committee and the CIA then said, publicly, which is the only scenario in which the Iraqis are likely to use whatever weapons of mass destruction they may have is if we attack them and they believe they're going to be destroyed anyway.
Mm-hmm.
They're very unlikely to use them if we continue to contain them and to prevent them from threatening their neighbors. And so what we're doing by attacking them is substantially increasing the risk of terrorist attack and substantially increasing the risk that the Iraqis will use or even give to others to use whatever weapons of mass destruction they now have. I know nobody who disagrees with that. It simply flows from the logic of the situation. It is the conclusion of the intelligence community and the conclusion of anybody who knows anything about Iraq.
And yet when President Bush was asked about that, Lawrence Korb, if I recall correctly, he said, yes, the CIA did say that, but they also said there was a grave threat that in the meantime, or that sometime in the future, they could give weapons of mass destruction to terrorists.
That's correct. And, they've also, tried to get a couple of situations. One, the supposed meeting in Prague with Mohammed Atta, one of the hijackers and from September 11th, and somebody from the Iraqi Foreign Ministry. They've also leaked a report to the Washington Post that said that, Saddam had given VX nerve gas to some al-Qaeda people in Syria, but they've never been able to prove that. It's very interesting. Back in the spring of 2000, in Foreign Affairs, the Condi Rice wrote an article and saying Saddam Hussein with nuclear weapons is no threat because he would be deterred just like everybody else, knowing that he'd get an overwhelming response against him.
What an inconvenient hostage to history that article is. Do you remember that as well, Mort Halperin?
I don't.
It was in.
I have no doubt that it's there.
Yeah, and in fact, it's been quoted by people, the so-called realists, like people like John Mearsheimer and Steve Walt. John's from Chicago and Steve is from Harvard, who are the real hard-nosed old Hans Morgenthau realists, and they say this war makes no sense at all, and they, up that quote.
They use that as an example.
Right.
Thank you. Mort Halperin, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Mort Halperin is a former official of the Clinton State Department, and he's now a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. We're talking this hour about American coercive diplomacy in Iraq and asking whether it's working. We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
from Boston.
I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're asking whether the Bush coercive diplomacy is working, even in Iraq, even if President Bush doubts it. We're asking, is the U.S. safer today with inspectors in Iraq, and would an attack on Iraq make us less safe? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Laura is calling from Dedham, Mass. Welcome.
Hi. I just wanted to ask, I don't support this administration and don't believe a lot of what they say, but when Bush and Rumsfeld came out and said flat out that we know that Iraq has, said as fact, Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, I thought for months that they would come forward with some evidence. I'm not clear. Are your two experts saying that that Bush and Rumsfeld were lying? And if so, what would have been the point of that?
Larry Korb?
Well, they do have... We probably have chemical and maybe biological weapons. They don't have nuclear weapons. And the question, the issue is now, did they destroy them, and, you know, when they knew the inspectors were coming, or will the inspectors try and find them and destroy them, or have they dispersed them so well that you can't find them? But this is what I think is what the inspectors will want and say, okay, you have evidence that they have them, and I think Laura, you know, could quote their statements. Okay, tell us where they are, and we'll go find them and see if, in fact, they have destroyed them.
But the U.S. has not provided that evidence yet?
No, well, not that we know have, and nor has the president, you know, made that presentation to the American people. I think what it's based on is circumstantial evidence. You know what they've imported. You know what the inspectors mm-hmm. found last time. You know what they destroyed, and sort of the process of elimination. But they don't know exactly where it is. And my guess is that what Saddam Hussein has done is he's dispersed this. I mean, chemical and biological weapons can be easily dispersed. You can put them in your basement and, mm-hmm. and places like that. Whereas nuclear, you would not be able to do that. And then a lot of this stuff is dual use. You may remember in 91 the famous baby milk factory that was supposedly destroyed.
Oh yes.
And so that's another problem you have with these weapons.
And we just saw that last week when Dr. Al-Baradei said that the aluminum tubes that the president, I believe, in his UN speech said were evidence of work on a nuclear project could well have been dual use themselves.
That's right. That's right. And that's the problem that you're going to run into. And, you know, Saddam Hussein up to now, I think, has surprised Bush by being so cooperative, you know, let them in, interview the scientists and all that. I don't think that's what they expected. I think they thought when the inspectors went back in, you know, very vigorously, that he would obstruct and then he could say, see, I told you, you know, this is the type of guy he is. Let's go get him.
Laura, does this make you think the government is telling the truth?
Well, I've thought for a while that no, I mean, that they think that Iraq must have them. But I guess I'd like to also ask your experts, and you might have already addressed this, but I'd like you both to, if you would, to state flat out what is the motivation for going so strongly against Iraq? Is it the Wolfowitz? If we, you know, we can actually create some kind of romantic thing, we can actually create a democracy in Iraq, and then it'll domino to all of the Middle East. Or what do you think is the administration's reason for this?
Larry Korb.
Well, I think the president felt after September 11th that the international environment had changed, and Saddam was the type of person who would try and give weapons of mass destruction to these terrorists and have a cutout, so that you would not be able to pin it on him. And he did not want to wake up one day with that happening and say, gee, I should have done something about it. So I think that's his first motivation where he's coming from on this. And then the other is this whole Wilsonian view that not only if you could get a democracy in Iraq, but if you did that, then the situation between the Palestinians and the Israelis would become under control because Iraq is behind it in one way or another. And then with an Iraqi democracy, the other authoritarian governments in that region couldn't, you know, remain authoritarian. So, I mean, it's a grand view, and I think Laura's quite right in attributing to people like Paul Wolfowitz.
Mm. Laura, thank you very much. Brian is calling from Bedford, Massachusetts. Hello.
Hi. Hi, Tom. I just want to make a couple points.
Sure.
Politically, I think this is going to be a loss for Bush if they don't go to war because the administration has been pushing so hard for it. Although I take your point that, you know, maybe these inspections are working and containment is fine. The other point I'd like to make is that even though the glass may be half full, this war, I think, according to the Bush administration, is not just about disarmament, but more of, you know, these other things we're talking about, regime change, bringing democracy to, you know, to a state in the Middle East and oil.
Let's take up the first of that. Lawrence Korb, what about the idea that this, that just not having a war is going to be a loser for Bush politically?
I don't think so, because, you know, a lot of the Democrats like Tom Daschle and Ted Kennedy are saying, let's, you know, let the inspections play out. And I think he can say that if the inspections continue to work and Blix and Baraday talk about how successful they are, he can say, well, I was able to do that without a war because I threatened a war. And I can't see the American people saying, gee, you know, that was wrong. We really wanted a war to spend this money and to see these young men and women die. So I really don't think he loses politically on that. There may be some, you know, so-called neoconservatives upset, but where are they going to go? I mean, who are they going to vote for in the next election?
Yes, and of course the president has yet to sort of say, make that judgment about other elements of policy, has he? He sort of stayed with the people that brought him to the dance. Brian, thank you for that. Siddiqui is calling from Roxbury, Mass. Hello.
Good evening. Yes, you know, it's been interesting listening to the conversation in terms of intellectualizing, you know, the intent of the Bush administration. You know, this whole thing around diplomacy and what have you, it's all a smokescreen. And what has transpired in the last couple of months only reinforces my perspective that this is about economics vis-a-vis oil, and also that Bush does need this war politically, because if he doesn't get this war, then people are going to start looking at this economy that's going down the tank and everything else that's falling apart. So he needs this war. So let's look at the scenario. You've got North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
North Korea, we believe you have these weapons. Yeah, we have them. What are you going to do? Well, this is the axis of evil, and we will not negotiate with them. Of course, we got North Korea with their standing army and backed up by China, which is a major factor here. And the bottom line is that Bush doesn't want to deal with them because he knows that, you know, that there's a no-win situation there. So he goes from no negotiations to, well, maybe, you know, we can come up with this agreement around not attacking China,
mm-hmm.
giving them food and what have you.
Yeah.
And then you've got Iraq, where there's no proof of anything.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like we have to take out Saddam for, you know, to save the United States. It's all a smokescreen. The bottom line is that this is about this oil, and that he needs this war because he's concerned about being just like his daddy.
And yet, Siddiqui, if you were the president after September 11th and somebody came to you with the scenario Larry Korb just mentioned, said this guy, Saddam Hussein, has got weapons of mass destruction. He could very easily give them to al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda could use them against us. And Iraq would say we had nothing to do with it and there'd be no fingerprints. Wouldn't that alarm you? Wouldn't that get you thinking about a confrontation with?
I think I'd be more alarmed that there's no inspectors in North Korea, and no one, there are inspectors in Iraq who are saying, look, you know, we feel that there's compliance here, and we're working very closely with them, and we need time. Mm-hmm. So going through the UN and through that whole platform, I'd be much more comfortable with that than talking about North Korea. I mean, what it is that the administration, just like past administrations, counts on the gullibility of the public to accept anything that they spoon feed them, and they keep them in the aura of fear.
Yeah, well, there certainly is plenty of fear and a lot to be afraid about. Siddiqui raises the point, Larry Korb, that occurred to me last week that really, if Bush is heading towards some kind of appeasement, aka diplomacy, with North Korea, that heightens politically the risk of war in against Iraq, doesn't it?
Oh, very definitely. I mean, I think any logical person sort of looking at this from the outside would say that North Korea is more of an imminent threat to the United States, using Bush's own terms.
Mm-hmm.
I think Bush's rhetoric got way out ahead of reality. I mean, he was determined to go after Iraq. When he gave the State of the Union speech, he put Iran in there because they were aiding Hamas at the time, and then he put North Korea in the show. It wasn't just against the Muslim world, never thinking that, you know, that he have to confront these two things at once. And now he's got himself really in a bind because people are saying, well, wait a second, it just doesn't make sense if you think threat weapons of mass destruction, particularly nuclear, these people are much closer. And then why are you going after Saddam? And the Muslim people in the Muslim world are going to say, well, wait a second, if you do go to war and this is the reason, what about North Korea? You know, it just doesn't add up. And I think what we're seeing here is that the president, by his own admission, didn't have much foreign policy experience, doesn't have a worldview, does not like the complexities of international politics, which was great after September 11th, because we all knew what had happened. It was horrible. Mm-hmm. We had to act. We had to act quickly. Mm-hmm. But then when you got back to sort of international relations as normal, mm-hmm. he's had to deal with these. I mean, look at who mm-hmm. gave North Korea the wherewithal to make nuclear weapons through uranium enrichment while their reactor was closed, Pakistan.
Mm.
And Pakistan's our friend that, you know, we need to fight, you know, Al-Qaeda. And that's why foreign policy is so complicated and why all of his predecessors have had to deal with these nuances.
He's essentially had to go beyond, or he's trying to go beyond, the black and white Manichaean diplomacy after September 11th, where they were evil, we were going to destroy him. Now he's in the gray world of
that's right,
yeah.
Which is where foreign policy is most of the time. Mm-hmm. If you take a look at mm-hmm. things, people we had to ally ourselves all the way back to World War II. We had to ally ourselves with the Soviet
sure.
Union.
Sure. Siddiqui, thank you for your call. Barry is calling from Brighton, Massachusetts. Hello and welcome.
Hey, how are you?
Well, fine.
This is a fascinating conversation here. I'm just sitting here listening, and then the last caller was he said a lot, but my question is, I hear all this rhetoric, all this stories, all this one has this theory, that theory, that theory. Condoleezza Rice was on TV this Sunday morning, and she said that the point is that 4 years ago when the inspectors were there, they knew what they had and they knew where it was. And in the paper report, they said they didn't have anything. She wants to know, and she said, what did they do with it? Where is it now? And they say they don't have it. So they know they have it. That's number one point. The second point, we know that the no-fly zone is filled with surveillance planes all the time, 24 mm-hmm. hours a day, where they can pinpoint and see everything on the ground. We all know that. I mean, not everybody knows it, but those who know.
Mm-hmm.
And the public doesn't know this, and that's another issue. So it seems that they do have all the evidence, mm-hmm. and it's all there. We know they're busy now setting up anti-missiles, mm-hmm. and we know that they're training their troops how to deal with the missiles and how to deal with combat. So it's obviously they're waiting to be ready, and they do have the evidence. So all the political rhetoric is just political rhetoric.
So you're saying that the Bush administration doesn't need to show evidence because in 1998 the Iraqis admitted to, or we knew, they had X amount of material which they did not include in their declaration. Therefore, they're hiding it. What about that, Larry Korb?
Well, that is the position of the Bush administration. And you started this off with James right in the beginning. You know, the question really is, who has to prove what?
Mm.
And from a strictly legal point of view, the United States probably doesn't have to prove it because Saddam is in violation of the UN resolutions. But from a political point of view, both at home and abroad, before you commit hundreds of thousands of young men and women to war, people are going to want to see the evidence. And you mm-hmm. just can't say, well, you know, the absence of proof is proof. They're going to want to know, okay, you say they have them. They say they don't. Where mm-hmm. are they? Show them, you know, show them to us. And I think that's what's lacking in this debate up to now.
Mm-hmm. Larry Korb, do you think finally that there's a danger here of the deployment driving the policy?
Well, I think there is, and Mort Halpern made the point, you know, whether we've crossed the tipping point.
Mm.
I hope not, because, yes, you will see people make the argument, well, you got all those troops over there, it's use them or lose them, you know, mm. and if you take them home, maybe they'll never get to go back again. Yeah. I mean, people have also argued that, well, Bush has got to go to war with Iraq because, hey, he threatened it. If you don't, then you'll undermine the credibility of the United States.
Of course, he threatened it if they didn't disarm. And if they disarm, then he's achieved what he wants without war.
That's right. Yeah, that's what he said. But, you know, then he talked about regime change, and then he said, well, if they disarm, that is a change of regime.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Larry Korb, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, it was good to be with you, Jack.
Always a pleasure. Lawrence Korb is a former official of the Reagan Defense Department and now with the Council on Foreign Relations. You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.